But we're looking at this, and Matthew chapter 10, verse 42 is what we're going to look at, and with a little advisement here. This is really the one that we're more familiar with on this particular passage or statement or what you want to call it, where Jesus said, whoever in the name of a disciple gives to one of these little ones even a cup of cold water to drink, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward. And a lot of times we look at that and we think to ourselves, oh, well, when he's talking about little ones, he's talking about children there. And there's some places where that might be so. But I really don't think that that's the idea here. And if you look at another gospel, Mark chapter 9 and verse 41, you'll see there that the wording is different and probably answers the question about who are these little ones, where it says, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because of your name as followers of Christ, truly I say to you, he will not lose his reward. I think that the idea there is that, yes, there are those disciples that are giving a cup of cold water to someone else, and it's to other disciples. There's no evidence that the little ones in Matthew 12 are... or Matthew 10, are children. And I looked in the context, and there's no evidence in the context either, but they are, in Matthew chapter 12, addressing the things in Matthew chapter 10, are addressing things related to disciples and so on and so on. And I think that's probably the idea of this. But anyway, there's also, how does this fit in with the idea of mercy? And it is something that's a small thing to do. But of course, it's something that would be a great thing, actually, when you stop to think about it. Small things oftentimes are indeed great things, greater than perhaps we have an idea. And just to give a cup of cold water is indeed a great thing. And I think it would be an act of mercy, someone that's thirsty. That's what they want. That's what they need. They don't need a long speech, and they don't need this and that and the other. You know, they need a cup of cold water. And when the last time now, when we were here, we looked at how mercy is necessary to and precedes forgiveness. That was the last lesson that we looked at last Sunday night. But then tonight, we're going to look at love and how it is in conjunction with mercy. And one of the things that we need to do is perhaps look at this with kind of a broad view of things. I want you to go to John chapter 15. And we'll see something there. And a lot of the things we're going to look at tonight, we might not necessarily find the word mercy or merciful or any of those other things that we've looked at some length where that word might be translated, for example, as pity or compassion or something along that line. It's not always found there, but we see that the concept or the act or what's going on, it is mercy that's taking place. In John chapter 15, verses 13 and 14. Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. So someone's going to lay down his life for his friends. Well, who is that? Well, of course, that would be Jesus here speaking of himself. And he's laying down his life for his friends. And who are his friends? The ones who will do what I command them to do. And him doing this, that was a supreme act of love. Of course it was. But that supreme act of love then allows us to receive mercy and to receive forgiveness. So I think we can understand how love and mercy are in conjunction with each other. Now, we did point out last week that without mercy, there really can't be any forgiveness. Not as the forgiveness that we see throughout the Scriptures. And I also think that there might be something that's done, and it might be acts of kindness and one thing and another, but it may not necessarily be all connected with mercy, unless, of course, there's some love involved in it. If you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, we're going to look at the subject of love. We're not going to go through this extensively and look at every aspect and other things along that line or anything. We're going to kind of keep on point as to how love would work in to this. When you think about 1 Corinthians chapter 13, think about the whole thing. Do you think you can see someplace in there, and maybe several places, where love would be involved with mercy? Just looking at the things just in this chapter alone. Now, hopefully we're able to see that. And yes, that love is involved with mercy. Look at verses 1 and 3. Now here, Paul writes, "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing." Now, he doesn't say in there that he doesn't or wasn't able to speak with tongues or prophecy, whatever that is. That's really not the issue. He says, if I don't have love behind that, then those things aren't going to do what they're supposed to do and capable of doing. And I think we see that. And even with faith, he says, you know, if I have faith to move all mountains, but if I don't have love, well, I'm nothing. And so I think we get the point there. And then when you get to verse 3, if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, I think feeding the poor would certainly qualify as an act of mercy. But now, if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, everything I've got, and people would be impressed by that if someone were to do that kind of a thing. I just saw the other day one of these millionaire actors out in California. He's not from California, not even from this country, but he's made millions, probably even billions of dollars making movies in the United States, and he was chastising the United States for not just diving headfirst into socialism. Well, socialism is that everybody gives everything into the common coffer and they divide it all up. That's socialism. I haven't seen him give up much of his possessions yet or income. You know, in other words, let me show you the way. No, he's just going to tell everybody else to do that. But I'll keep everything I've got. Well, I don't think very many people are going to pay attention to that. But someone that would give everything they have, I think that would leave an impression on someone. But he says here now, if I do that and do not have love, it profits me nothing. So do you think mercy's something that's important? And do you think love's involved in this? Boy, here we go. I think love's behind several things. And I don't think that mercy is necessarily excluded. Then we get to verses 4 through 7, where it says, love is patient, love is kind, it is not jealous, love does not brag, it is not arrogant, it does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And then the first part of verse 8, love never fails. So it never fails in all of these things. Now I'm sure someplace in here, we ought to be able to see where there's some mercy involved. Now several times I've mentioned about, you know, cutting somebody just a little bit of slack. And I think you find that here at the latter part of verse 5, where it says, the New American Standard has, does not take into account a wrong suffered. Okay. And that's kind of a long way of saying that they don't keep a list. They don't keep a list of grievances, real or imagined. They don't do that, you see. They don't take into account an accounting where you're recording all this. Doesn't do that. Why don't you do that? Well, you know, we'll give somebody a break. We'll cut somebody a little bit of slack. And especially should we do that until we know the whole story, because sometimes it's easy to assign a motive or something or another and then find out later on that's not so. But in verse 7, it says, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And I wonder sometimes if we do enough of that. You know, giving someone the benefit of the doubt. I think that kind of sums up everything that's said there. Now, it doesn't mean that because we're Christians, we become gullible and just believe everybody about everything. I think all of us are probably experienced enough as Christians to understand that there's people that come along and they'll have a tail as long as your arm, you know, one of those things, and you've got no way of checking it out or anything along that line. They'll look at you and, oh, well, I'm an honest person. I got no idea whether that statement's true or not, you know. And there's a lot of things where it comes down to it, you know, you're just going to make a judgment call almost on the spur of the moment. And sometimes, you know, we ought to give somebody the benefit of the doubt. I don't think we should always come out on the negative end of things. But I think sometimes it won't hurt us if we give someone the benefit of the doubt. And especially, I think that should be the case with someone who actually is, and you know they are, a brother in Christ. So I think verses 4 through 7 are centering on, you know, personal interaction. And with our personal interaction with one another, there's going to be ample opportunities for us to show mercy to someone else. And I think that's something that we ought to do. And, you know, we'll all have to decide whether we're doing this enough or not. And to realize, I don't have to answer to anyone else as to whether or not I have shown sufficient mercy. I don't have to answer to anybody here tonight. And you don't have to answer to anyone. You certainly don't have to answer to me on something like that. You do what you think you need to do. You cut the slack. You give the benefit of the doubt where you think that that's something that ought to be done. And then the person who in the final analysis will decide on how you've done this, that's God Almighty, not the preacher, the elder, or anyone else. And I think that's something that a lot of times we just lose sight of. We get into the point to where, well, this is what I would do, and that's right, and if anybody else doesn't do that, they're wrong. And if they do more than that, well, they're just fools. Now, trust me, I'm being pretty blunt here, but I've seen that kind of attitude over the years. And I just think to myself, my goodness, you know, whatever happened to mercy? Because, you know, mercy, one of the ways mercy is translated in the New Testament is this kindness. Can't we at least be kind? But again, not gullible now. But there's got to be some place where we've shown some mercy at some time. And if our life exists and we've never done that, I think it'd be a sad existence. Now, excluded from what you find here in 1 Corinthians 13 are such things as gamesmanship. You know, a person's just doing this for some kind of personal advancement or whatever it is. You know, it's like they're playing some kind of a game. It's not for lording it over others. Well, I've been merciful to you, aren't you? Don't you show some appreciation? It's not that kind of thing. And another thing, this evil suspicions, I've said enough about that. The King James has evil surmisings in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 4. But you look it up in other translations, it's evil suspicions. And we're not supposed to be involved in that kind of thing. That's something that's sinful. And yet it seems like it's something that folks fall into quite easily. Now, there are other considerations on the subject of love that come up. I think you go over here and you can make a case from any or all of these passages in John chapter 13. And in verse 34, Jesus said, "A new commandment I give to you, and what is that? That you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another." Did Jesus show mercy to others? Did he not lay down his life for others? Yeah. And so we should show mercy. See how that works? And is that motivated out of love on the part of Jesus? Yes. And it should be motivated by love on our part. Not that it's something, well, that's just my duty to do. You know, something along that line. You know, I remember one time listening to an older gospel preacher, and he was talking about what you find there in 1 Peter about, you know, showing hospitality without grudging. See that? Without grudging. And, you know, and his explanation of it, kind of unusual, but it fit the character. He said, that's the person, you know, that says, well, I guess I ought to have the preacher over for dinner, whether I like having him over to the dinner or like him or not. They're showing hospitality, aren't they? Is it without grudging? Sure doesn't sound like it. That's how he would explain it, and I understand that. Now, how about mercy? Well, that could kind of work the same way, you know. That I ought to do whatever. Well, I guess everybody else is. I ought to do it too. That's not it. No, it's actually, it's a commandment that you do this. And you do it out of love, and that's what Jesus did, that's what we should do. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 1, let brotherly love continue. And a passage that has always been a favorite of mine, matter of fact, about all of Philippians 2, has always been a favorite of mine, but especially right there at the beginning. We'll just look at verses 3 and 4, though, and not go any further than that. It says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, watch, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. If I was going to approach this from a negative standpoint, these two verses, and I was going to try to take the position that mercy isn't something that's necessary or anything like that, and I come over here and someone says, it appears to me that there would be mercy involved in here, and I didn't think that there was mercy involved in here, how would I make an argument about that based on what's said here? How would I begin to even start? Well, I'd start, I guess, by saying, I don't find the word mercy there. Well, fine. I don't find the word mercy in what Jesus said, greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for friends. I don't find the word mercy there either. But I sure wouldn't deny that mercy's not there. I wouldn't deny that mercy is there. And I get over here, and I don't know how I'd deny outside of that, just saying the word's not there. I think the concept is there. I think that's what it's calling for. Certainly that's part of the mix that you find in those passages. So love is something that's important. And I think it's found in conjunction and connection to mercy. As a matter of fact, I'd go so far as to say, like we did last week about forgiveness, if there's no forgiveness there, or if there's no mercy, there's no forgiveness. Well, if there's no love, there's no mercy. And how does that work then? Well, there's love, and then there comes mercy, and then there comes forgiveness. Seems to me like they'd all be right there in a row in the right place. No, that's how it would work. I've got a couple examples here. And actually, I kind of think that they're self-explanatory. We'll make a few remarks on it. Turn to Matthew chapter 25. Matthew chapter 25, and we'll look at verses 34 through 40. It's in the teaching about the sheep and the goats. So starting in verse 34. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you blessed of you who are blessed of my father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat." Now start right there. Is that mercy? Yeah. And what follows is like unto it. "I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." And the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry, or feed you, or thirsty, and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger, and invite you in, or naked, and clothe you? When did we see you sick, or in prison, or come to you?" And the king will answer and say to them, "Truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these my brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me." Well, it seems to be a question to follow here, and I don't think this taxes anybody's thinking. If you ask, is there love and mercy involved here? I think that there is. Isn't there? You necessarily find the words there, maybe in some other translation. I'm the one unaware of it. But I think that's what's going on, isn't it? And I think we can see that. And I don't think we've got to, you know, I don't think you have to have I would say a PhD, but how about a THD, a doctor of theology? You don't have to be that. You can see that. But then, you know, without this, either or both, you know, without love, either or both becomes something that's grudgingly done. And I don't think that's the idea there. And I think that we can see that. You know, you have a love for others, and then these acts, which would constitute acts of mercy, follow along after that. And I mentioned in Bible study this morning that we'd be looking at Luke chapter 15 tonight. Again, we're not going to go through every single solitary passage on this. We're familiar with it. It's either one parable or three parables, or perhaps it might be four parables. I'd be inclined to say that, well, it's either three or four, but then that doesn't really matter, and Jesus just calls it one. Whatever the case is, the teaching is important. A parable was always given to teach somebody something. And in many of the cases of the parables, those who the teaching was for, it spelled out. And you know what? It is here in Luke chapter 15. So as we go down through this, one of the things that you have to remember, or you just lose sight of what it's all about, is really it's the targets of the teaching. The targets of the teaching are right there. Look at verses 1 through 3. All the tax collectors, that's publicans, and the sinners were coming near him to listen to him. Both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." What a terrible thing. And so he told this parable, saying this. Now, I think we mentioned last week and probably the week before. It boils down to something like, they wouldn't do this. They would not invite tax collectors and sinners to eat with them. They wouldn't be happy if these were people that came in mass like they did to Jesus to listen to him. They wouldn't have been happy about this at all. They would even discourage it. They might even be to the point of trying to run them off. And certainly whenever this happens with Jesus, they find fault with it. Do you think that they're happy about it? And it all boils down to, well, that's something that we wouldn't let happen. That says a lot, doesn't it? And this parable, he told them, you see that in verse 3? He told them this parable. This is for you. To realize, you know, what just exactly what's going on. In verses 4 through 7, what man among you, If he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost till he finds it. When he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. When he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost." I tell you, in the same way, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Sheep had an intrinsic value in these times. It's how wealth was determined, had been that way for centuries. Abraham was a very wealthy man because of his flocks and herds. It still was in the first century. So losing a sheep wasn't, wasn't like it is maybe today. Because it had an intrinsic value. And they would look long and hard for this. And other people would join in and help look off. And the Pharisees and the publicans, they'd go out and look. How about the Pharisees? Would they do that? And the scribes? They'd go out and look too. Because it had value. Now all the other things in there are good and proper, but don't lose sight of the fact of what he's driving at here. They'd rejoice over this. Over a sheep. Then verse 8 and 10, what woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and search carefully till she finds it? When she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin which I had lost." In the same way, I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. How'd she lose the coin? She got 10 of them. How'd she lose that? I remember reading one time, I thought it was, good as anything. A person said that these coins had been made so that they could be worn on the wrist. All of them together, like on a band or a string or something along that line. And that it could, something like that, break and they all fall down onto the dirt floor inside these houses. And they found 9 of them, couldn't find. Well, that's, I don't know whether that's true or not, but maybe it is. I don't know. All I know is that she had 10 of them and she lost one. How she lost it, I may have knocked it off of the, table or what, I don't have any idea. But she lost it and now she's looking for it. I get the idea that she's looking kind of frantically for this. And there may have been others that helped her in the house or maybe a neighbor or something. Help you look for it, find it. In sweeping, you might be covering it up even more so, Lots of things to consider here. But she finds it. But you know what? That coin's got intrinsic value as well. And the scribes and the Pharisees, we'd be looking for that. Sure. No problem there. We'd help you find it. Yeah. But then how about in verses 11 through 24 when a son goes astray? A human being. That's different. Isn't it? Now you ask yourself, would these scribes and the Pharisees have an interest in helping find that boy? I think based on what you see up there in the first 3 verses, you'd be inclined to say, I don't think so. So the sheep and the coin had more value than he did. Well, you don't think that these publicans and sinners that come to Jesus have got much value, do you? That's not much of a leap. So was there love and mercy there for the son gone astray? I think there was, though. Maybe not from them. But now they need to learn a lesson on this. And as much as this son and all the mistakes that he made and how he took everything and just blew it, and everything that was involved, and can't wait to get away from his father, and all those things, everything that you see in a negative light, he finally comes to his senses. And I'll go home to my father. And I'll tell him, I've sinned against God and against you. And I think to myself when I look at this, and I'm a father, and I look at this and I see that how when the father recognizes that the Son was coming, says verse 20, a long way off. I wonder to myself, Father, if the Father knew what direction that boy left, he went down that road there, last time I saw him. Did the Father stand there and watch until he was out of sight? I don't know. Possible. And then I wonder, every day when he went out about his business, did he look down that road to see if that boy was coming back home? Did he do that several times a day to check if he's coming back home? Because you know what it says? He sees him a long way off, far away off. He must have been checking him, watching for him. Did he do that because he was disappointed with his son? He had ample reason to be, and a number of other things. I think he was looking down the road and everything because he loved his son. Hoped that he'd come home and see him again. And lo, here he comes. And the Father saw him and felt compassion for him. I think that's mercy. Love and mercy. And what did he do? He ran and he said, "You've got some nerve coming back here. Let me list all of the ways in which you failed me." I think there might be fathers that would do that. But he embraced him and kissed him. And the son said exactly what he said that he would do. He'd sinned against heaven in your sight, verse 21. But the father was glad he was home, called for a celebration. He said, "This son of mine," verse 24, "was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found." And they began to celebrate. Would those men have done that? The target there, would they have done something like that? Doesn't hardly seem like it. No. You know who represents the target audience? It's not the sheep. It's not the coin. It's not the lost son. It's the elder son that represents the target audience. He finds out that his older brothers come home and they're having a party for him. And he's just mad about this. He goes to his father and lays out a whole raft of grievances in front of him as to why this just shouldn't happen. "Well, you've never had a party for me." That's who it is here. And do you notice here that this is the thing about the elder son that stands out? He's so much like people today when something happens. You know what he did here? He made it all about himself. Didn't he? It's all about me. Me, me, me. That's everything that he's... And even when he's talking about his brother over there, he gets around, "It's all about me." You know anybody like that? I know several people. I've got relatives like that. And it's just where you're just left shaking your head. But now here's the thing. Where was love or mercy for his brother? Where'd that... Do you see that with the elder... No. That's who the target is here. He represents them. So the elder son stood for the targets of the teaching. There was a lack of love, and no surprise, a lack of mercy. So now we should learn this from this teaching here and not get ourselves sidetracked on some things that honestly are incidental in this. I know people that get themselves all wrapped up over the dividing of the inheritance and whether the father should have done that and this and that and the other. And I think to myself, keep going and you lose sight of what this is all about. That yes, indeed, it is all about mercy. And behind the mercy is the love that brings about that kind of thing. And then here's what it's like with the absence of it. And it's not very pretty. Not at all. Now take your songbooks and turn to the song that's been selected there. We're going to close by going back to what we started with in the first lesson, and that was in the Beatitudes of Jesus, where it says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." One of the things that we ought to have learned is that if we want mercy, and we do, we want mercy. We want mercy to be extended toward us. We want God to show us mercy. Are we willing then to be merciful? If we are, we'll receive mercy. If we're not, we won't. You can look at James chapter 2 and verse 13 and you find that out. But anyway, the lesson's yours. If there's anyone tonight that would like to receive mercy through the forgiveness of sins in becoming a Christian, the opportunity is yours to do that. Believe in Jesus Christ, repent of your sins, be happy to help you and baptize you this very hour. If someone has fallen aside like the prodigal son and wants to return, well, you will try our very best, all of us together, to help you square things with God, and that which was lost can be found. If you're subject, why don't you come while together we stand and sing.